Lecture 20, Economic Growth and Social Unrest.
The focus of our lectures so far has been almost relentlessly on the political life of the Hellenistic Age and the social life of the Hellenistic Age. We've been looking at poetry, at sculpture, at religion, at novels, at the political history of the various dynasties established by Alexander's successors. But there is, of course, another very important aspect of the Hellenistic world that we really must address, and that is that of economic activity. How did the Greeks experience a world in which their culture and their economy, their settlers, their production, their relations of production, were now scattered over a much larger area? What effect did this have on economic activity? How did they respond to this? Well, we're going to see in the course of this lecture that we see an expansion of economic activity. But as is so often the case in history, it does not mean that the prosperity created by this is evenly distributed to everyone. And so we're going to explore in the course of this lecture both the economic activity of the Hellenistic Age and the social tensions created by this great wealth but its unequal distribution. In some respects, we really are seeing a Hellenistic Age that seems to resemble our own world. The first thing that must be said in any lecture about any aspect of the ancient economy at all is that the ancient economy, in comparison with the modern economy, was by and large a rural economy. The vast majority of people were engaged in simple subsistence farming. The vast majority of people, certainly at least 90% of the people of the ancient Mediterranean, lived the same kind of life in the countryside, whether we are talking about archaic Greece, the Hellenistic world, or the Roman Empire. Most people are going to be concerned for most of their lives with farming and with raising stock. Nevertheless, even if we accept that the vast majority of people are engaged that way, there are significant changes in organization in the economy, the technology of the ancient economy, and trading practices, which together will mean that the economy is critical to the stability of the Eastern Mediterranean and will undergo significant changes in the Hellenistic Age, despite the fact that most people carried on life as before. For example, we know that the production of staples during the Hellenistic Age increased as the result of newer, faster-growing varieties of wheat, producing more crops and more productive crops. And other new varieties of fruits and crops were being encouraged by the Hellenistic kings as well. So we have a greater control of the economy and experimentation in new crop types. We also know that at the level of technology, more iron plows were being used and different and newer types of presses for olive production, for example, were introduced, and this increased the productive capacities of the Eastern Mediterranean at this time. Another significant change in the period, which surely had a major impact on the economy, was that of irrigation, which was expanded. We have evidence from archaeology at various Hellenistic sites, of course, both in the Nile Valley, where irrigation has been a traditional feature of cultivation, and up into other areas, such as the Ukraine, with its broad rolling wheat fields, and even far east into Bactria, the so-called upper satrapies, where irrigation was either introduced or, if it was already in existence thanks to the Persians, dramatically expanded under the rule of the Hellenistic kings. So this would have brought more land into production, and it would have made more productive land that was already under cultivation. There's mass production going on in the Hellenistic world, a mass production of pottery. It increases on a scale previously unknown in the Mediterranean. And this you can measure archaeologically in shipwrecks. You can measure it in the volume of pottery from different periods that you find, which you can then compare at sites. And luxury trade as well also increases, even though it is lower in volume than the trade in staples. There's much more wheat and grain being sent around the Mediterranean than, say, cedar wood or perfumes. It's lower in volume, but it's potentially much more lucrative. You can get a much higher return on luxury trade because you can charge very high prices if materials and goods are scarce and rare and have been brought long distances. This also increases dramatically in the Hellenistic age. We know some of this because of different amphora types that are readily identifiable. This allows us to chart trade patterns across the Mediterranean, in particular the shape of an amphora, the shape of its neck, the shape of the point of its foot, and the shape of its handle. These are highly distinctive, and it allows you to see goods being transported across the Mediterranean because we have an idea of where they came from thanks to their amphora types. We know staple goods such as wine, oil and grain that are being traded from productive areas such as Egypt and the Black Sea that are then moving to areas which are less capable of feeding themselves. The great metropolis, the great cosmopolitan cities that are now emerging in the period, say Alexandria, Athens, Pergamum, and even, and particularly later on, Rome. So we've got lots of good evidence, lots of reliable evidence for an increase in production and an increase in trade. There is simply more stuff being moved around the Mediterranean. And as for luxury goods, well, we have spices coming all the way from India. We have slaves and ivory being brought up from sub-Saharan Africa. We have amber being brought down from the Baltic and tin coming from as far away as Cornwall. So the lines of production extend way beyond the Mediterranean, out to the Atlantic, down into Africa, and across into Southeast Asia. Because these precious goods, because many of them are originating from outside the Mediterranean, they are therefore exotic, of course, and of high economic value. So they bring a great return on the investment for someone who can bring in a shipment. And the final bit of good concrete evidence that attests to the increase in trade in the age, both in staples and in luxury goods, is the notable increase in shipwrecks. We simply have many, many more shipwrecks after 250 BC, and if we think that shipwrecks remain a constant proportion of the actual amount of shipping going on, and that seems fairly logical, then it would tend to suggest that there was an increase in volume of seaborne trade going on in the Hellenistic age. All right, so there's simply more going on, more being produced, more being brought in, more being shipped. But more, an increase in economic activity does not lead to an increase in prosperity for all in the Hellenistic age. There is reliable evidence, for example, in the coins minted during the 3rd and the 2nd century that money was consistently losing value. The Ptolemies gradually lightened the silver tetradrachm from 17 grams of silver to 15 grams of silver down to 13 grams of silver. So a devaluation in the actual value of the currency. Furthermore, gold and silver coins tended to be used only for international trade, whereas for ordinary people in the countryside, in many parts of the Hellenistic world, and particularly in Egypt, copper coinage was used, so that many people, even by the very currency they were using, were excluded from the kind of prosperity being brought in by trade, by international trade. We have some quite graphic evidence of the way that the Ptolemies tried to keep control of this coinage as they made it necessary for people, as they came into Egypt, to have their coinage reminted. It was a way of constantly dipping into the coinage coming in and using it to add to the value of Ptolemaic coinage. Not that it was always successful. As with any other great bureaucracy, there were glitches, and some of our best evidence for the tight control of the Ptolemaic economy comes from the petitions and letters we have that attest to the moments when it broke down. For example, here is a letter from a character called Apollonius. It's a letter to Apollonius, who is a high-ranking official in the Ptolemaic government, coming to him from one of his agents, a man named Demetrius. And the letter says, "If you are well, that is good. As for me, I am devoting myself to what you wrote to me to do." So this is a lower functionary reporting to his boss. "I've received 50,000 drachmas of gold, which I minted and returned. We would have received many times as much, but as I've written to you before, the foreigners who come here by sea, the merchants and the forwarding agents and the others, bring their own fine local coins to get them back as new coins in accordance with the ordinance, which instructs us to take and mint them. But as Philaretus, and we're not quite sure exactly what his rank is, but he's some sort of minting official by the looks of it, but as Philaretus does not allow me to accept them, we have no one to refer to on this matter. So a low-level functionary has been given one order, but the man who's meant to be dealing with, who's meant to be helping him to put this into practice, in other words, to take the money of the foreigners and to remint it, won't help him. And so this junior official doesn't know quite what to do. The men are furious since we refused the coins at the bank, and the document breaks off for a moment, then it resumes. They cannot send their agents into the country to purchase merchandise, but they say that the gold lies idle and that they are suffering a great loss since they brought it from abroad and cannot easily dispose of it to others even at a lower price. Nobody in Egypt will take their money because it hasn't been reminted as Ptolemaic coinage. So the Ptolemies, by controlling the exchange, are really controlling the economy. And as for people in the city of Alexandria, they're all reluctant to use the worn gold coins, the older ones. None of them knows who he can refer to. And so the letter goes on, and unfortunately we don't know what the response was, though I would think that given the nature of the Ptolemaic economy, they found a solution to make it more efficient to gouge out their little bit of profit. Effectively then, profits in international trade, and that's really where the profits lay, were often channeled straight into the hands of the royal dynasts, who monopolised production. And of course, the other people, the jackals around the lion and its carcass, who also fed at this table, to mix some metaphors, were the agents of the dynasts. Their agents, such as Demetrius and Apollonius, who would get their cut. And then, of course, the cities, which would be the ports at which this trade would be funneled, places such as Delos and Rhodes and, of course, Alexandria. So once again, the cities, which are the sites of Hellenistic and Greek culture, would profit from this. The dynasts and their functionaries would, but the people in the countryside probably saw very little increase in their prosperity as a result of this. We've seen devaluation going on in the coinage. It goes hand in hand, of course, with inflation. And there were no economic theorists in the ancient world who were able to understand adequately the mechanisms of the economy and to be able to deal with this. But we've got dramatic evidence for periods of rampant inflation during the Hellenistic age. A measure of wheat, which cost 75 copper coins in the 3rd century, 100 years later cost 350 copper coins. And at the same time, the ratio of copper to silver had actually plummeted from 1 to 60 to 1 to 455. So the combination of inflation and devaluation certainly meant that the ordinary people who couldn't get their hands on silver coinage were kept right out of the loop as far as prosperity was concerned. When people did manage, fortunately, to transfer some of their copper coinage or some of their produce into real silver or gold, which had genuine value, they hung on to it. And as a result, we have most of our hoards of Greek coins from Greek history coming from the Hellenistic period. That's when people finally got their hands on gold and silver and put it underneath their mattress or put it in a jar and buried it under the floor. People wanted to keep coins because these gold and silver coins had real value as bullion. There were other factors that were important in limiting the development of a free and healthy economy as we would know it today. First of all, salaries. Well, salaries were often paid partly in produce and partly in artificially low wages, making it difficult for soldiers and low-level bureaucrats to improve their economic position. They weren't actually getting much in the way of valuable coinage that they could then trade. Rather, they were basically paid in kind, given food and sustenance, and then a small allowance, as it were. Secondly, and we know this is an important part of the modern economy, credit. Credit was available, but it was very expensive in the ancient world, varying from 10 to 12% interest rates to 18 to 22% in times of unrest and disturbance. So it was difficult to be able to borrow money, to be able to invest and to therefore take part in the economic activity of the age. Related to this, insurance is virtually unknown in the Hellenistic world. There is really only one category of insurance that exists, and that's of bottomry. that is to say maritime loans. But because moving stuff by sea was a hazardous business, you never knew when a fleet would go down. Correspondingly, the cost of a maritime insurance policy was extraordinarily high, 20 to 30%, so that it was an expensive proposition to be able to both invest in a fleet and then to guarantee by insurance the material that you were shipping by sea. And then we cannot talk about economic activity in any period of human history without, of course, mentioning taxation. Taxation, you may be surprised to hear, was unpopular in the ancient world. It was unpopular not only because taxes are inherently unpopular, but also because of the method of collection. In the ancient world, taxes tended to be collected not directly by a government official, but rather by a private person who had signed a contract with the government to collect taxes. That way, the government was guaranteed their money because the tax collector actually forked it over. But of course, the tax collector then was in a position of adding a commission to the original taxation amount so that he could make a profit out of it. So, people who were being taxed were even paying for the privilege of being taxed by fellow citizens. The name for this, of course, in Latin for these tax collectors is publicani, and that is why often in translations of the New Testament we hear of publicans and sinners. It does not mean that hotel keepers had a bad reputation in the ancient world. It's because publicans is a funny translation for tax collectors. We have a very startling piece of evidence regarding the degrees of taxation. We know that in Egypt taxation was more rigorous and at a higher rate than anywhere else in the Hellenistic world. But also because of the sand of Egypt and the papyri that we have very detailed evidence of how taxation worked there. For example, here's a document that records goods that were brought in across the Gaza Strip, a boat that sailed down the coast of Lebanon and Israel and across round towards Egypt, and it entered Egyptian territory at the site of Pelusium, near what today is Gaza City. And as the ship came into Egyptian territory, it came into port, a Ptolemaic customs agent would go aboard and he would read the bill of lading and he would check all the contents of the boat, record everything, and then present the captain with a taxation bill on the spot. Fortunately, this would be in duplicate, and then the captain would be able to show later on to the owners of the goods what he'd paid in taxes. This is just to give you an idea of what was being taxed on this boat. The boat is captained by a man called Patron, and the bill of lading includes grape syrup, filtered wine, ordinary wine, white oil, Chian jars of wine, half jars, Thasian jars, jars of wine from other areas, and some jars of dried figs. Now, what do you suppose would be the taxation on those goods as they came in? The import tax on them was 33 1/3%. Fairly drastic. And then the same boat, excuse me, a boat captained by a friend of his that they came through together at the same time, a fellow called Heraclides, has on board such things as wild boar meat in a jar, a pot of the same, two large jars of venison, a couple of small pots of goat meat, a basket of hard sponges, some cheeses, and various other goods of this sort, and they're taxed at 25%. So taxation, which was ubiquitous, was not popular, and in Egypt it certainly must have had an effect on limiting the amount of goods that could be brought in except by those agents of the king. Now, the total effect of this, the total effect of the coercive nature of government, of the disproportionate allocation of the prosperity of the age, led, along with a number of other factors, of course, to widespread social unrest. And this is a feature of the age that we really need to spend some time looking at. The most startling evidence for this, of course, is the widespread phenomenon of piracy. And we've already had an opportunity to look at this and to see how some people responded to it. We saw in one case from the island of Amorgos, when a group of women and some citizens of the state were carried off, the men offered themselves as hostages to the pirates to negotiate the release of the women slaves and their fellow citizens. And you'll remember that I remarked in dealing with that particular instance that piracy was very well organized. It tended to originate from well-identified areas, Aetolia in northwestern Greece, Crete, Cilicia. And these pirates preyed on the shipping lanes of the entire Mediterranean. If you regard a map of the Mediterranean and look at these locations, you'll see that any trade which goes by coast from the eastern Mediterranean to the Aegean, in other words, from the coast of Syria and Lebanon and Israel and Egypt, around into the Aegean, to the western coast of Turkey and to Greece, must go past the southern coast of Turkey or Cilicia. So the pirates there were absolutely perfectly situated to be able to just sail out and grab anything that went past. Similarly, if you go then from the eastern Mediterranean across towards the west, the other places that you'll go past will be Crete. Boats sailing from there can nab anything that goes past. And if you sail up the west coast of Greece and start heading across towards the heel of Italy and around the toe of Italy, you will have to go past Aetolia, where again the pirates were simply able to sail out and grab anything. So they weren't simply single marauding ships, rather they were highly organized fleets, often with hundreds, even thousands of men. Now they're a particularly interesting phenomenon because I think they explain to us that power in the Hellenistic world tended to be effective only as far as it could be enforced. Only as far as the troops of a Hellenistic king could go. And central authority then was based on towns, and beyond that, all bets were off. It's sometimes been pointed out that in the story of the Good Samaritan in the New Testament, we have a suggestion of robbers operating on a major road in Judea, not terribly far away from major cities. But as soon as you're outside the walls of the city, it's possible that you're going to move into bandit territory. And these pirates are like an alternative society for those who are tired of the taxes and of the oppression of the Hellenistic kingdoms. They just go off and act as marauders. In response to the dangers presented by piracy, I've pointed out in an earlier lecture that many states and sanctuaries actually agreed to recognize each other's rights. They refer to this in the Hellenistic world as asulia, or the right of asylum, and they actually will negotiate with pirate states, saying, allow us to be free of piracy, and presumably they would pay something over for that right. So places had to deal directly with the pirates. But what about if you're not a city or a kingdom? What about if you're an individual? What do you do in this world where at any time you could be robbed and beaten, where policing is essentially ineffective, and where if you're outside of the city, you might find yourself grabbed by slavers and ending up on the auction block on Delos or Rhodes? Well, for many people who simply got tired of this, the answer was to flee, to run away from society. And in Egypt in particular, we have a widespread phenomenon in the Hellenistic world of people not becoming priests of cults and joining the temple estates, but becoming almost a lay brotherhood associated with the temple estates. These are known as, in Greek, as katakoi, which means recluses. And we have an example of this from the great Serapeum, the temple of Serapis, at Memphis, where one Greek individual named Ptolemy, again, not the king, of course, but just the same name, where he went and lived for a number of years claiming that he was in detention. And this phrase, which turns up in many of the documents, seems to mean that he'd had some kind of epiphany, some kind of dream or visitation from the god, where the god had said, I want you to come to my sanctuary. And he's kept there for a number of years. While he was there, he didn't manage to avoid the kind of random attacks that people were afraid of. He says in his petition to the local governor, I've been living in detention for a number of years. And while I was in detention at the Serapeum, I was attacked. Some men with stones in their hands and others with sticks broke in. They tried to force their way in order to seize the opportunity to plunder the temple and to put me to death because I was a Greek. Okay, this is very interesting because it's an example of the tension between the various ethnic groups. because I'm a Greek, like men laying a plot against my life. But when I anticipated them and shut the door of the temple and shouted to them to withdraw in peace, they didn't go away even so. And one of the other Greeks, who's also in detention, eventually expresses indignation at this and comes to his assistance. So we're reading about a brawl that's actually going on in what is meant to be the safest haven that you can imagine, the Temple of Serapis. Even there, you weren't safe. Similarly, another response to the upheavals of the time, apart from piracy and becoming a recluse and simply running away, was the phenomenon of mercenaries. Some men simply said, "Why stay in Greece and die a slow death of starvation when I can grab my shield and my spear and I can sign up?" And of course, there was always ready work for them, because as we've seen, the various Hellenistic kings tended to rely on mercenary armies. Now, such men have always been a part of the Mediterranean world, but they become much more numerous and much more prominent in the Hellenistic period. Hellenistic monarchs relied on these mercenary forces. We have lists from Egypt, for example, and from Syria, where we find men drawn from all of the old towns of old Greece coming to serve their new Greek and Macedonian overlords. There is a dramatic change towards the end of the 3rd century in relation to this, when, after the Battle of Raphia in 217 BC, the Ptolemies start including more and more Egyptian forces in their army. And they actually have Egyptian battalions at the Battle of Raphia. But the effect of this is, in fact, to weaken their dynasty. There are more and more rebellions going on after this period, as the Greek dynasty becomes weaker. And so we can imagine some people running off to become mercenaries, some people running off to become pirates, some people running off to temples to become recluses, and some people just raising arms in rebellion against their king. Here's a description of one such rebellion from 160 BC. It's in Egypt, and it occurs in the area known as the Thebaid, the region around Egyptian Thebes. "Yet another disturbance took place in the Thebaid," writes Diodorus the historian, "as a revolutionary fervor fell on the masses. King Ptolemy advanced." Note the language in this, the reference to Greeks and Egyptians. "King Ptolemy advanced against them with a large army and easily restored control over the other parts of the Thebaid. But the town called Panopolis is situated on an ancient mound, and because it is difficult to access, it is thought to be a strong position. So the most active of the rebels gathered there. Ptolemy, seeing the desperation of the Egyptians and the strength of the place, laid siege to it, and after enduring every kind of hardship, he captured the city, punished the culprits, and returned to Alexandria." It's very much the work of an occupying force coming down from Alexandria, a Greek and Macedonian army under Ptolemy, coming to reassert its authority in the Egyptian zone. So it's another example of the strong sense of a divide between the two cultures. One of the most interesting ways in which the unrest of the time finds expression is through popular literature. And I'm not talking now just about the Greek novels, though we have seen motifs there of shipwreck and capture by pirates. But we actually have in the Hellenistic age what is sometimes referred to as resistance literature, texts that demonstrate that people were writing about their oppression and were opposed to it. The Sesostris romance, as it's called, from Egypt, constantly refers to the belt wearers, and the belt wearers seem to be the Greeks, and it is a reference to the fact that the Greeks in their midst were wearing their sidearms, their swords hanging from their belts. Another interesting example is called the Nectanebo romance, and it's an historical novel in which the Egyptian pharaoh Nectanebo is presented as the father of Alexander the Great. So in this way, the oppressed Egyptians are claiming that really the great man of the age, Alexander, was one of them. He's not really one of the Macedonians at all. The Potter's Oracle is set even further back. It's set back in the time of the 18th dynasty, so it's an historical novel going back a long way. And back in the 18th dynasty, according to this oracle, there is a prophecy of a future time. A future time when the Greeks will kill each other and once again the Nile will flow full and straight. So, like many such documents, of course, it is about contemporary events, but it is set in the past and then projects forward into the future, an alternative to current conditions. So, what we find then in the Hellenistic Age is that there were many different responses to the economic developments. The rich got richer, but the poor didn't. And their response to that was either to run away and live in a monastery, and in fact the monastic impulse, which become important in Christianity, really originates at this time. Or they join an army and go off to Ptolemy and become one of his mercenaries. Or in some even more imaginative instances, they write an historical novel, but a novel which predicts the end of the Hellenistic world.